Last week in our study of Galatians 4, 12 through 20, we were looking particularly at the question that Paul raised in verse 16. Have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? And we know that he's trying to head off an anticipated reaction on their part that would make them think that he didn't like them, that he was out to hurt them in some way, because he refuses to allow them to go in the way they're going without confronting the error of their thought and the reality of their movement away from the God who called them in grace. Anytime somebody confronts you and you're at fault, you tend to want to not feel like it's your fault and just think that maybe they've got something against you. And Paul anticipated that. But in our study, we basically zeroed in on the issue of the fact that enemies seek the actual hurt of their adversaries, and that in every real sense, the truth can never be used in the service of a lie. It just simply cannot sustain or support something that's not true. So no one can ever use the truth to forward a lie without first twisting the statement of the truth so that though the words may be accurate, the meaning is not. It's been twisted. That's the only way you can get a statement that looks to be true to sustain or support something that's not true. It takes a lie to sustain a lie. So it's impossible for him to become their enemy if he's actually telling them the truth. And of course, that's the issue. That's what the Galatians have struggled with ever since the false teachers come to town and began to say that Paul hadn't told them the truth. That was their accusation. He's misleading you. He claims he's an apostle of God, but he's not. He's lying to you. He's deceiving you. He's telling you stuff that's not true. And they're appealing in all of these things to the baser nature of their hearers, because they're basing their arguments most fundamentally on what most people would accept as the truth. You want God to bless you, you're going to have to behave yourself. If you really think that you're going to be able to participate in the life of God and the blessing of the inheritance that he has laid out, if you want to be a part of that, you're going to have to commit yourself to obeying him and behave yourself and do the stuff that he tells you to do. And it's all about your obedience if you want what he's got. And almost everybody would say, well, yeah, I guess that's really true. Can't really expect God to bless you if you're not going to obey him. Problem is, that's not true. And that's Paul's whole point of contention, ball of contention here in Galatians. He's got the gospel of the grace of God, where God does you good when you don't deserve it. And in fact, there is never a situation where outside of grace you can deserve anything except bad things. I mean, if God is going to give you what you got coming, you'd be in a world of hurt. That's just the way it is. And so if you are going to base any expectation of God being good to you, giving you a pardon and inheritance and all, it's going to have to be rooted in his grace, because it certainly can't be rooted in his justice. So the bottom line is, Paul is claiming to be telling them the truth, and his adversaries are saying that's not true, he's lying to you, and therefore the Galatians have a problem on their hands. They have to decide who's telling them the truth. But Paul's got the history, the reality, on his side, because they formerly had an awareness of the blessedness of being right with God, and that sense of blessedness which they had motivated them to a kind of selflessness that they'd never experienced in their whole lives before. They were willing to have their eyes plucked out for his sake, if it would help him. And that's such a selfless act that it's just impossible to honestly feel that way without somewhere being motivated by the Spirit of God to do it. So, the gospel produces this kind of movement beyond yourself so that you can actually be loving and selfless and all that kind of stuff. And Paul says, you once were there, but you're not there now. So, what changed? That's the issue. And his holding them to that standard has caused him to anticipate that they're going to think he doesn't like them. He's just scolding them and he's berating them and he's their enemy and all and on. And he just raised the question, is that even possible with me telling you the truth? So, basically, that was an issue that he had, he forced them to consider in verse 16. And then he turns the table on his adversaries in verse 17 and 18, and he exposes their motives. Why are they telling you that I'm lying to you? What is in it for them? What are they trying to get out of you? What is their goal? If you're going to be so considerate of whether I'm your enemy, you need to stop and ask yourself, how have I ever hurt you? And what did I set up to gain from you when I brought the gospel to you? You remember? Was it me throwing rocks or was it you? You didn't suffer at my hands. I suffered at the hands of some of your countrymen, but you cannot honestly charge me with having injured you in any way. So how have I been your enemy? And these people, if they're going to be telling you that I'm your enemy, what are they trying to do? And that's what verse 17 is going into. They eagerly seek you, but not commendably. They wish to shut you out in order that you may seek them. It's a good thing always to be eagerly sought in a commendable manner. And not only when I'm present with you. So this evening we're going to look at this whole issue of the opponent's attitude. What is their motivation? What are they trying to do? And I want to set it in the context of the larger picture in the text and in the larger context of biblical theology. In verse 14, Paul raised the specter of the Galatians being led astray by a thing he would call temptation. That's always a problem. But he says in verse 14, that which was a temptation or trial to you that existed in the fact of my bodily condition, you didn't buy into that. You didn't yield to that trial. You didn't yield to the temptation to look at the superficial thing and make an arbitrary decision on that basis to just reject what I had to say, even though I didn't look like much of a recommendation. I mean, he came to them on the heels of having been stoned to death. His body was bruised, his face was scarred, his eyes were in sad, sad shape. He didn't look like a very good recommendation for faith in the gospel. And yet, he said, at that time, the temptation didn't get you. But since then, something has, because some things have changed. So when he addressed the issue in verse 14 of a trial or a temptation and commended them for not being deceived into rejecting his message because of his appearance, he is setting the stage for the question that he raises then in verse 15. So what temptation came and how come you succumbed to it the second go around? I mean, you had this blessedness, this blessed state, because you weren't deceived by a temptation. But now that blessedness, the sense of it, the impact of it, is gone. And that means, it has to mean, that you've made some changes. You've been led into some kind of an error. The issue of temptation is the underlying problem in the Galatians situation. They are being tempted to jettison their relationship with the God of grace. They're being tempted to jettison their confidence in the gospel of Jesus Christ crucified. They're being tempted to jettison their commitment to eternal truth for some cause. And the cause is outlined in verse 17. So it's an underlying problem. The temptation issue is an underlying problem. But the fact that they didn't succumb in verse 14 means that they were once strong enough to resist. They had a blessed condition that enabled them to recognize the problem of making a judgment about the truthfulness of a message based on the appearance of the messenger. They had enough sense to not do that, and that sense came from something. Paul would say that that something that it came from was this truth of the gospel that gives you this sense of blessedness. Once they were strong enough to resist, so what happened? And the fact that something happened has already been, we've already talked about in verse 15, the fruit of the blessedness. And that fruit being an actual selflessness that was so profound that they honestly would have allowed someone to pluck their eyes out of their heads if it would have helped Paul, if their eyes could have replaced his in his head. Paul is not speaking hypothetically or, you know, hyperbolically, hyperbole, whatever. He's not talking in hyperbole. He's talking about an actual sense of selflessness that came out of them because something had entered into them, the truth of the gospel. So they had this blessed condition that was producing its fruit, but that fruit is now gone. And it's at the root of Paul's theology that when the fruit disappears, something doctrinal has come into the picture that is absolutely false, but it's being accepted as true. When the fruit of truth disappears, it's only because somebody has started believing a lie. That's the only time that you can get the fruit of the blessedness of the truth to disappear in a person's mind or in their life, is if you can get them to shift into believing something that's simply a lie. A doctrinal shift. That's what started out in Galatians chapter 1. You're leaving the gospel for something that's not a gospel. Now, if there has been an actual doctrinal shift, somebody has created a powerful and successful temptation to which they have succumbed who were guilty of shifting. They believed the truth. They had the benefit of the truth. It was being expressed in their lives. And then somebody came up with something that caused them to stop and say, whoa, I'm not going this way anymore. I'm going to go this way. That shift is always rooted in some kind of a doctrinal aberration, some lie that has got the coating of truth surrounding it. It's Paul's strong conviction that those who have created this potent temptation need it to be exposed at the level of their own motivation. That's what verse 17 is doing. He's going to tell them, okay, you want to know what's really going on here? What's really going on here is that these people have come to you to tell you that I'm lying to you because they want you to depend on them to give you the truth. That's what's going on. They want to interpose themselves between you and your relationship with God so that you can't have a good relationship with God without them. That's what they want. They want to be eagerly pursued, so they are eagerly pursuing. They eagerly seek you. They wish to shut you out so that you will eagerly seek them. Now, what's that really all about? Well, to understand it, I think we have to go back to the biblical theology of temptation, because in the Bible, everywhere you run into temptation issues in any clear presentation, there's always only three fundamental areas where you can be susceptible. And the tempter will always approach in either one or two or three or a combination thereof, of the three areas, the only three areas in which you are susceptible. And he will do whatever he needs to do to try to get in under the radar so that he can get you to succumb to the temptation. That's his whole goal. So, and you all know this, man's susceptibility starts and ends with his fears. We're in the most danger when we are afraid. Temptation is only effective when it is able to create a scenario of fear with an answer. So that because you're afraid, you will go this way. It's kind of like somebody wants you to go right over here, but your inclination is to go over there. So they put a whole passel of crocodiles right over there. And you say, well, I guess I can't go that way. I'll go here. No, over here there's a whole bunch of Rottweilers. And they say, well, I can't go that way because of the crocs, and this way because of the dogs. I'll go over here. And all of a sudden you find yourself with a whole pit full of poisonous vipers. You say, well, can't go that way because I'm afraid of them, and I'm afraid of them, and I'm afraid of them. I guess I'll go this way. And that's the direction that the person wanted you to go in. That's why they created these areas of fear, to force you to go where they wanted you to go. And by the way, God's capable of using that too. He can use our fears to get us to go where we need to go. But typically, it's not God who's using our fears. We're most susceptible when we're afraid of something. And in the area of our fears, there are only three areas where anything's at risk, where fears can dominate us. We're afraid of physical pain and death, physical death. We're afraid of relational conflicts and the risks that it brings with it. Because when you get into a relational conflict, you don't know what that person that you're in conflict is going to do to you. There's a fear thing there. Used to, you could say whatever you thought of somebody, and if they didn't like it, they'd ball up their fist and swing at you. And if you were fairly good at fisticuffs, you didn't care. And even if you weren't good at it, if you liked the fight, you didn't care because you weren't afraid of that. When I was in high school, the worst thing you had to worry about was some pachuco taking a chain that he took off of a bicycle and whacking you with it. Or maybe a tire tool that he might hit you over the head with. That was about as bad as it got. But these days, everybody's packing heat. You aren't just going to get your head busted or your skin laid open. You're going to get killed. Relational conflict is always that kind of a threatening situation these days, because the boundaries of what people are willing to do to somebody they don't like have expanded. Used to, the boundaries were kind of hit them a couple times in the mouth and see what they do then. But now the boundary is shoot them a couple of times and see if they're still wiggling. And so we have these relational conflict fears because we don't know what's going to happen. And then in the area of the spiritual things, is we're terrified of absolutely being worthless, of being considered insignificant and being just totally humiliated because we're absolutely worthless. Those are the only places where you have anything at risk. If you're not at risk of being physically hurt, and you're not at risk of adversaries doing something to you because there's a relational conflict, or you're not at risk of being humiliated and considered worthless, you're not at risk. Those are the only three areas there. 1 John says that. That's all there is. So, man's fears are what lay him open to the susceptibility to be tempted, to be driven in a given way. And the tempter knows that. And he's interested in only one thing, and that is using fear to get people to do something for him that he wants them to do. And what is it that he wants them to do? Well, invariably, it's going to sooner or later come down to the question of, why are you doing this to me? What do you want from me that you're oppressing? You're capitalizing on my fears to get me to do what? And when you look at the temptation accounts, most clearly revealed in Genesis 3 and Matthew 4 and Luke 4, the whole book of James, those are the areas where temptation is the focused issue. And invariably, somewhere in there, you're going to find somebody saying, if you'll just bow down and worship me, you won't have to be afraid of anything. And that tells you what he wants. He wants you to acknowledge that he's superior to you and that you owe him allegiance in some form. That's the tempter's desire. That's what's going on in verse 17. They want to be eagerly sought. That means they want to be put on a pedestal. They want to be an intermediary between you and any source of blessing you might have from some other source, whether it's God or somebody else. They want to be the one who decides whether you'll get that or not. They want you thinking that they're the ones who will decide that, so that you will always go to them to make sure that you're going to get what it is you want from whoever it is you want it, because they're the key and they want to be there. It's no accident that just enormous numbers of religious groups stick somebody between you and God. It's no accident. It's on purpose. They want to be there because it gives them a sense of superior status to you. And that's where they want to be. That's as old as Lucifer saying, I want to be the God. I want to be exalted on the pedestal of the throne of heaven. That's as old as it gets. But you can only be driven there by fear. You can never be driven there by truth. Even the person who says that God wants you to be afraid of him enough that you'll worship him has got it a little bit twisted. Because God's not trying to get you to exalt him between you and somebody else as a source of blessing. See, God's got you in mind. He's got your best interest in mind. And he knows that your best interest is going to be served when you recognize what the truth is and believe the truth, because it is out of the faith and the truth that the blessing comes. And he knows that. So he's going to push you to trust him. But it's not for his sake. What's he going to gain? Look at it. This is a corny illustration, but look at it this way. How much do you think an elephant eats in a day, as big as they are? And let's suppose that an elephant decides that he wants to be fed by a whole bunch of ants. How many ants is it going to take to haul all the stuff that an elephant needs to eat? Well, he's going to have all kinds of slaves. Millions of ants to bring all this stuff he's going every day. So basically, if he moves when they come bringing the food and he manages to trample on about 30 or 40 of them and smash them into the dust, what's he really lost? What they were able to bring is nothing in comparison to what he wants to eat. Well, in a very goofy way, that kind of explains how little we have to offer God. He's not doing this for his sake. He's not doing it because we have something we can bring to him that's going to really make his day. He's doing it because he's got something that will really make our day. And so he wants us to recognize and believe the truth, because we're going to have the joy and the blessing of the truth. Because that's who he is, and that's how it comes to us, is when we trust, believing. So that's the difference between the temptation and the God of truth. But the fact is, there is a very subtle approach outlined here in verse 17. The goal is at the end of the verse. The false teachers want to be exalted on the pedestal. They want to be seen as the instruments of blessing. So what do? To get you to see them that way? Well, they put you on a pedestal in your mind about what they're thinking. In other words, they make you think that you're important to them. What they really want to accomplish is to be important to you. But in order to do that, they try to convince you that you're important to them. It's kind of like all the country western songs, you know, where the professions of undying love and I just can't live without you. And all, basically, all of that is words that are designed to get you to treat me that way. You know, it's not so much that I can't live without you. I want you not to be able to live without me. That's what it's all about. And all the words, and all the song, and all the melody, and the whole, everything's designed to blind you to thinking that you're the one who's going to benefit, but really, the issue is, you're going to be trapped and become the slave of somebody that wants something from you. So they're going to make you think that you're the one on the pedestal, all the while they're wanting to be on one above you. That's what verse 17 says. They're eagerly seeking you. What does eagerly seeking mean? Well, the word eagerly seek means pursue with a single-minded focus. It's kind of like, of all of the things you're going to waste your energy on, or spend your energy for, not waste it on, but spend your energy for, of all the things that you're going to spend your energy on, you're going to pull all of the stuff that's not important, and you're going to shove it aside, and you're going to pull this energy down to a laser focus, and you're going to shoot right at that target. That's the only thing you really want. And Paul says that's the way they're treating you. They're treating you like you're the only person that means anything to them in the whole world. They're zealously in pursuit of you. They have focused their attention and their interest on you. And that means that the Galatians are the objects of focused interest. And that means that they're extremely valuable to the people who are focusing their interest on them. And that's a heady, heady feeling. There's nothing that is more attractive to most people than to be so important to somebody else. This is really the issue of extreme value placed on somebody. And extreme value placed on somebody is the issue of the L-O-V-E word, love. Love means to have a focus of attention on somebody, a high value. You've placed this value on them. And in a very real sense, love is always going to be in the mix because it's the root of everything done in the whole world. Now, it can be the love of the world and it can be the love of God, but the bottom line is nobody ever does anything that's not important to them in some form. Love drives everything. It's because somebody wants this that they do that. It's because somebody wants this that they do that. There is nothing that you do that is not driven because you want something. And that's love. That's the desire for. That's the focus of value on. So love's always going to be in the mix because it's the root of everything done in the world. But it's also a matter of arranging the things that are considered to be important in an ascending or descending order of value. Love is always saying, I want this more than I want this. I want this more than I want this. I'm going to have to arrange what I want here. This is what love is all about. It's deciding, well, I'd rather have this than that. I'd rather have this than that. I'd rather have this than this, or this or this. So love is all about selecting. What is it that you want? And of course, all of us have experienced that whole mix because all of us are married. And we decided on one person out of all these other possibles. We all did that. We decided I'd rather have this one than that one. We all did. Because love is a matter of arranging things in order of whether they're valuable or not. And it's always, love is always a matter of some absolute criterion by which the decisions are made in terms of how the arrangement is going to come out. When somebody says, okay, you said this is more important to you than this. Why do you want this? Always there's going to have to be an answer. Why do you want this? Well, mainly I want this because I want this, and this will get me that. Okay. Why do you want that? Well, because if I get that, then I can get this, and I want this, and this will get me that, and this will get me that. And so, you know, it's all about what you want and why you want it. And almost invariably, the why you want it is going to be somewhere along a whole stair step of things that you want. The top of the heap is the bottom line, where you say, okay, top of the heap, what is it that you finally want? That's the issue of love. And love is always going to make some hard and fast decisions because it's committed to its bottom line. And so if this comes along and it's pretty attractive, but it has nothing to offer to the bottom line, and say, well, it's really pretty, but I'm over here. I'm interested in this. It's kind of like the guy who just thrives on really well-done, restored old cars. And he just, every time he sees one, he just wants to go over and look at it and touch it and rub the paint and, you know, see his reflection and all that. And somebody walks the winner of the dog show past him. He said, man, isn't this a fine dog? And so, I don't know if it's a fine dog or not. I ain't interested in that. It's all about where your focus is. What do you want? That's what love is. It's a issue of what is it that you want. But the difference between the love of the world and the love of God, the issue in verse 17, the bottom line question is always going to be finally this. In your love, who's going to profit? And that's the question. Is your love all about this because you will profit? If that's the love you operate by, you're going to die. That's the love of this world. The world's only interested in its profit. You have never loved anybody or anything well unless that somebody or something really doesn't have anything to offer you. Then you have loved with a kind of love that God operates by, because God doesn't love us because we have something to offer Him. He loves us because He's got something to offer us. So, bottom line is the question, who's going to profit? And the issue of these extreme zeals, these eagerly seeking things, the issue of extreme values are always dangerous. The issues are always dangerous because the question of who profits is not always immediately raised or recognized. When the Galatians began to be treated so enthusiastically as the objects of the zealous pursuit of the false teachers, they didn't know what the false teachers were seeking. They only knew the good feeling of, man, it feels really nice to be treated so well. It's really something to be held up on a pedestal by somebody. It's really neat to have somebody constantly complimenting and praising and, you know, that's nice. I like that feeling. And Paul says that's what they're doing. They're creating that feeling. They want you to feel like that they really care about you. They want you to feel exalted. But there's a hook in it. They're doing that to you, according to verse 17, not commendably. In other words, they really don't want you. I mean, their goal is not for you to feel treasured. Their goal is for you to treasure them. That's the goal. But it's not immediately apparent. That's what's so dangerous about it. People aren't saying, maybe I ought to ask who'll profit here. I honestly believe that all temptation will be frustrated immediately if people would simply stop and ask themselves, okay, who will profit if I take this route? If this route that's being set before me is a legitimate route, it will be exposed as legitimate by the question, who's going to profit here? And if the answer is, well, I am, well, then you've already succumbed to temptation. Because that's the danger of a twisted kind of love.
It's one thing to be the one who's doing the loving. It's an altogether different thing to be the one who's being loved.
Which would you rather be? The one who's doing the loving and may not get anything out of it? Or the one who's being loved and is going to get everything out of it? Which would you rather be? Be careful. That's where the danger is. If you would rather be loved than to love, you're already sunk. If you would rather be loved than to love, you're already dead. Sunk.
If you can be deceived into thinking that there's an automatic good to being loved, rather than an automatic good to loving, then the whole war has been lost. Because you can squeeze this question of final profit out of the picture and just think about the oozy-goozy feelings of being loved. Paul is saying in verse 17, they make you feel like you're loved by them, but they're doing it because they want you to start to love them to the point that you will put them between you and God. They eagerly seek you so that they can shut you out. And then you'll have to go to them in order to get back in. The Galatians miss the reality that came from the blessedness that was theirs. The Galatians realize that they've lost something. They once had a freedom in joy that they don't have anymore. And they miss that. And they want it back. So the false teachers come in and they try to create that for them by, you know, building them up and patting them on the back and commending them and all that, eagerly seeking them. But their real goal is to get you to see them as the means to that sense of blessedness. Well, that's fundamental idolatry. God is the source of that. And nobody, you can't let anybody stand between you and God and get that blessedness. So it's really clear that Paul's saying in verse 17 that the false teachers are not driven by wanting to speak the truth. They're not like Paul, who's willing to tell the truth, even if it makes the people who are hearing it think that he hates them. He's not interested in that. He wants to tell them the truth because it's impossible for him to be their enemy if he tells them the truth. He wants to tell them the truth. The false teachers are not interested in the truth. They're interested in being exalted. Whatever it takes. Whichever means is necessary. That's their real motivation. And by exposing their motivation, he's exposing their doctrinal error. Any doctrine that does not move us to a more selfless perspective, a more other-focused objective, a better desire to be useful rather than to be benefited, any doctrine that doesn't push us in that direction is simply not true. That's Paul's argument. You guys had this in your hands. You had this in your hands. You were honestly willing to sacrifice, incredibly sacrifice, just because you thought I might need some help. And you've lost whatever it was that was driving that, and you missed it, and you want it back. And you think they're going to give it back to you by telling you the stuff that just makes you feel good. So that's not what it's about. So that's what verse 17 is driving at. It's an exposure of their false motives. Because you have to understand the baseness of the motivation in order to be able to sidestep the temptation. If Adam and Eve in the garden had simply looked at the serpent in the eye and said, "Why are you saying this? What is it that you're trying to achieve here? You really want us to believe that you have our best interests in mind by the things you're saying to us about this one who's already proven that he has our best interests in mind? Is that really what you want us to believe about what you're saying?" If they'd have stopped and asked those kind of questions, they'd have never succumbed. But they didn't. That's the problem. A lot of times the people who are promoting the doctrines that will kill us make it look awful good. But it's deadly because it turns our attention on to ourselves. And as soon as that happens, we're dead in the water. Questions, comments?